Welcome, everyone, to the new Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdern, and with me is my co-host, Mr. Barry Rose. How you doing, Barry?
I'm doing fantastic.
And on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We're going to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. On today's episode, we're going to discuss three, count them, three of my top 100 matches of the 80s from the 1989 Wrestling Yearbook. And to begin with, before we start, I want to give a couple shout-outs. I'd like to give a shout-out to my friends who are not on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. My friends over at the Obtuse Angles Podcast. It's a podcast that I listen to. We talk back and forth more than people know. And they recently did a great podcast. They include, much like we do here, wrestling, pop culture, movies, that kind of stuff. And they're a fun listen. Although I want to say if we're PG, they go perhaps PG-13 sometimes. So I wouldn't listen to it while you have your five-year-old in the car. But anyway, great bunch of guys. And I would really encourage you, if you're looking for something new and different after you listen to Breaking Kayfabe, because you're going to listen to us first, then check out my friends Kyle and the other guy at Obtuse Angles. Jeremy? Okay. I couldn't remember the other guy's name. Sorry.
So Kyle and the other guy.
Hey, Kyle's the one that I talked to. So a couple things before we start. Barry, I know you want to tell the good folks that listen here to Breaking Kayfabe, we've got an upcoming CWF Fan Fest in Tampa that you want to make a special announcement on. Why don't you tell the folks what you got to say?
Absolutely. So tickets have just gone on sale, this being Tuesday. Tickets went on sale this past Saturday at 7 o'clock. So we have we've already announced our two headliners, which are Bob Roop and Steve Kern. They'll be doing a two-hour Q&A with a catered dinner limited to only 50 fans. With the Q&A is moderated by none other than
who?
Jeff the Booker Bowdren. You, sir, you'll be
doing the moderation
on this.
It's not Kyle and the other guy. It's actually me.
It's not Kyle and the other guy, which is really, that was one of my favorite bands in the early 80s. They came over from Belgium, Kyle and the other guy.
Yeah,
remember they sang the song about the balloon?
Yeah.
They were fantastic. But yes, so you will be doing the moderating for this two-hour Q&A where Bob Roop and Steve Kern are going to dig deep. They're going to talk about their record-breaking feud in Florida. It was one of the biggest feuds of all time. But we'd like to make an announcement right now that we are adding a third guest, and we will continue to add guests every week, but we are adding former North American and Southern heavyweight champion Buddy Colt.
Boom!
Living legend Buddy Colt. Oh, yeah. Buddy Colt making a very, very rare Fan Fest appearance. I believe in the last decade he has made two. And his buddy is getting up there in age. He's slowing down a little bit, and it took some finagling, if I can use that word on this show. But Buddy has agreed, so we're very excited that he'll be there. You can get tickets by going to eventbrite.com, searching CWF Legends Fan Fest 3. You can also find us on Facebook, CWF Legends Fan Fest, or Championship Wrestling from Florida Archives, and I'll also be posting the link on the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry page.
All right, and what's that date again, Barry?
That is June 2nd, occurring in the beautiful city of Lutz, Florida. Lutz is a suburb of Tampa, and we were going to be at the Marriott Residence Inn at North Point Village on Suncoast Parkway. It is the longest name of any hotel in the entire world, I believe, but we'll be there all day June the 2nd. We have fans coming in from all over the country, so it's really, really exciting. I am so looking forward to this.
And in the words of the great Freddie Miller, don't miss it. Be there. Okay, we are getting ready to jump right into more of my top 100. But before we do, Barry, I have a special surprise for Mr. Rose. A special guest appearance. Guest appearance.
A surprise for me?
Just for you, buddy.
Oh, wow. Bring it on.
Recently on the message board at facebook.com/breakingkayfabe, Travis Raines asked the question, how did Jeff and Barry meet? I did a little deep dive on this. Barry, do you remember how we met?
Yeah, I think I do. At least I have my version of how you and I met.
Well, my version is that we were introduced by our good friend, the man I call the professor, Mr. Pete Lederberg. Pete, why don't you go and say hello to Barry?
Playboy Barry Rose, how you doing, brother?
Surprise, surprise, surprise.
Jeff Bowdrin keeping me that's unbelievable, Pete. So I've known Pete, and it's funny, I was just talking with somebody today, this morning, regarding Pete, that I've known Pete probably longer than anybody else in my life at this point. I think we're like 41 or 42 years, so I consider him family. So yeah, that's awesome, man. This is awesome.
Well, I have asked Peter to join us because Peter, as most of you people listening to this show realize, was part of the famous or infamous, depending on how you look at it, WFIA angle in Memphis with Tommy Rich and Eddie Gilbert. And today on the show, one of the three top 100 matches that we are going to take a look at, we are going back to 1984. We are going, in fact, to May 14th in Memphis at the Mid-South Coliseum. Eddie Graham, Tommy Rich, the new Fabulous Ones, facing off with Coco Ware / Stagger Lee, as he was called, both ways in the match, and Norvell Austin. So, gentlemen, we're going to discuss this match. I'm going to throw it to you, Barry, first. Tell me what you saw in this match, whether or not you think it still holds up as a top 100 match.
I think it definitely does, too. So I was able to watch this match. So it's a good match. I mean, at the end of the day, I think the first half of the match, it's a falls count anywhere match. It's a good match. But what really separates this from other matches is the fact that they are going to go all over the arena, but they wind up on a stage at the Mid-South Coliseum. And listening to, I don't know who the announcer was. It didn't sound like it was Lance to me, but
it was Randy Hales.
That's it, because it wasn't Lance for sure. But anyways, so they wind up on a stage, and apparently this stage has been set up for some sort of concert. So there's like this like dramatic effect where they're brawling all over the stage, which is above the crowd, which is super cool. Norvell Austin takes this really wicked back body drop onto the stage, and then Norvell either falls off the stage, or, you know, he takes a bump. It looks to me like he's falling off the stage. Coco's getting body slammed on the stage. And there's a spot, too, where Eddie Gilbert tackles him. He tackles Coco, and it's like a football tackle. He gets him right around the knees. He goes down. And then Jerry Calhoun, who's the referee, gets attacked. He gets punched, and I think it's by either Rich or by Gilbert, and a DQ is called. But I like this because there's kind of this chaotic effect to this match. You know, this is something that where they're going all over the arena. The stage really is dramatic. And the truth is, Rich and Gilbert were a good team. There was no way they were going to be able to follow Kern and Lane as far as the Fabulous Ones, as far as a work rate and several other, you know, factors also. And Rich is kind of, he's out of place. I mean, he just doesn't look like the guy that would be teaming with Eddie Gilbert. They're different body types. There's kind of a different look to them, too. Rich is taller. He's heavier. He doesn't look good wearing the tights and, you know, his belly's hanging over. At the same time, they were a good team, and I like this match. It's a fun match.
You know who Tommy Rich was in this match? He was Matthew McConaughey in Dazed and Confused. He was the guy who was a little too old to be in that role. You know what I mean?
That's a really good analogy. Yeah. That's exactly
what
he was.
You know, he had the bloat. He had the tights like Mike Rotunda used to wear his tights, like a little too high in the waist because he was trying to hide that beer gut. This was actually what they called an explosive match in Memphis, which means falls count anywhere in the building. Before I give you some of my thoughts, Peter, you had a chance to watch this as part of our surprise package for Mr. Rose. So tell us some of your thoughts on this match.
Well, a couple things. First of all, just so, you know, keep the record straight, when you were talking about this, you said Eddie Graham and Tommy Rich, and I'm pretty sure it was Gilbert.
My bad. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it wasn't Eddie Graham.
Yeah, but the interesting thing
that's
about
kind of a,
Tommy
that's
Rich
That's kind of a pretty decent faux pas on my part there, Pete. Thanks for pointing
yeah.
that out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
it's a definite, right there. I like that one.
Okay. See if you're ever a guest on this show again, Letterberg.
Well, I see if I care. You know what I'm saying?
We're a highbrow show. I don't know if you're aware of this.
We are the Art House Podcast Show.
This is the Art House Wrestling Podcast.
Hey, wait. I was a couple things that made me crack up. First of all, yeah, I noticed the same thing. It's Randy Hales doing the announcing. And they used to have a show in Jackson, Tennessee that would run a lot of the Mid-South Coliseum matches. I don't know if you guys knew that. It was like, aside from the Memphis show on Saturday that was live, they would run a show at Jackson and they would show a lot of highlights. And that would be my guess as to where this was from, you know, because Randy would do that part. But one thing that cracked me up in this match, I was talking to Jeff about this earlier. In the middle of the match, Eddie, and I forgot which one it was, it might have been Norvell Austin, it could have been Coco, it could have been Staggerly, you know, because they kept using different names for Coco in the match. But which they locked up, lock up collar and elbow in the corner. And how do they get out of that? They just break the collar and elbow and just start punching. Typical Memphis thing. You know, no arm drag, no working an arm, nothing. Just collar and elbow tie up, punch. It's pretty funny to me. But those guys, the other thing is that, yeah, we considered, say, Tommy Rich was, you know, too old for this. But am I wrong about this, Barry? Steve Kern older than Tommy Rich?
Yeah, but I think the difference, too, I mean, so Steve Kern was always in shape. I think Steve Kern is still in shape, and he's 65, 66 years old. And Tommy just looks – that Matthew McConaughey analogy was really spot on, is that Tommy looks to be about 6 inches taller than Eddie Gilbert. Eddie's in good shape, you know, but Tommy's just kind of Tommy, you know. He doesn't – certainly, I would even take the age aspect out of it. They just don't look like a team. That being said, they were actually pretty good, though.
Yeah, just like you said, they were like weird, and like you guys both said, you know, like trying to fill the Fabulous One shoes, not the easiest thing. And they really didn't look like a team. Absolutely, I'm just
now,
you know,
now were
playing
they,
with
were
you.
They, did they get made a tag team? Wasn't it because the Fabs at this point had gone up? Had they gone to the AWA by this point, Pete?
Yes.
Okay, and that's why the promotion basically created a new gimmick, you know, babyface tag team. So like I said, this is an explosive match, which meant falls count anywhere in the building. They do at the beginning of the match, they do a fake split between the heel team of Coco and Norvell. So before I get to talking any more about this match, I also want to stop and say, you know, you look at Coco Ware, and so many people remember Coco Ware for being, you know, Coco Beware with Freddie or whatever, the Frankie the Parrot on his shoulder. And it, as just a gimmick performer, Coco was part of a couple of really good tag teams in the Memphis area, because his team with Bobby Eaton in the early 80s was a really strong tag team. And this is a guy that's like been forgotten in time as being a really good worker.
Yeah, and he had the thing going where you talk about being short. I mean, he's tiny, but you said it perfectly. One team after the other, Eaton was the big one, but he teamed with Austin longer. And Austin's another name that gets lost in time, too. Barry will know more about him teaming with Sputnik Monroe and whatnot. But he was around forever and one of these guys that you would never think of as like a top guy or anything like that. But he was someone that fit in with so many different teams and always did well.
Yeah, he was also part of the original Midnight Express, wasn't he, with Dennis Condrey and Randy Rose down in the Southeast. He was almost kind of, you know, you're absolutely right when you said he was a guy that fit in with so many great tag teams. He was sort of like almost a Buddy Roberts guy, the way that Buddy fit into the Freebirds, you know. He was a guy that could take the fall and would never lose any heat because he was such a good performer. He worked, you know, mainly in the southern part of the U.S., but what a really solid hand. And so anyway, getting back to the match. So when they take what I thought was interesting was when they take the match outside the ring, there's a spot where they're brawling in front of the fans and the cops go and stand between the fans. I guess the fans were getting a little too close to the action. That was pretty funny. So, and then I'm not sure if it was Tommy or Eddie, but one of the baby faces gets the cane across the back of the neck and then the cane to the throat. It was just a great spot. Barry mentioned Tommy and Norvell up on the stage and Norvell getting a backdrop on the top of the stage. That must have done wonders for his back, I have to tell you that. So Gilbert and Coco going up into the stands, the tackle. Tommy Rich is the baby face, and he flat out punches the referee right in front of everybody. Coco takes the bump off the stage. This, to me, it was a 12-minute match, and it was a prototype of – when someone talks about a Memphis brawl, a tag team brawl, this was like a prototype of it. Now, Here's a question for you, Barry. Is it a top 100 match of the decade?
It's not. It's not. At the same time, I would probably rather watch this than maybe 60 or 70% of the top matches of the decade. It's so entertaining. It's so much fun. To me, and you just said it, and I know Pete, who I've always considered kind of an expert when it comes to Memphis, this is the prototype of Memphis right here. When I think of Memphis, this is exactly what I think of. And let's be honest, you know, Eddie Gilbert gets a lot of respect among the hardcores. Tommy Rich, Norvell Austin, Coco Beware, Stagger Lee, they don't. These are names that are never brought up in getting any respect. This match is fun. I watch this, and I want to see a second match from these guys.
Well, and it's funny you should mention that because, of course, there is a second match out there, which is a match that took place, I want to say, either a couple nights after or a couple nights before. And that's when these four guys had a match in Memphis that ended up going back towards the dressing room. And Barry and I also had a chance to watch that. And Barry, tell me what you thought about the Nashville match.
Yeah, so I think I like this one a little bit more. It's the first match, again, that stage to me I just thought was awesome. That should always be done in that regard. But what I liked about this match, Rich is bleeding buckets. And, you know, if you've ever seen Rich bleed, especially in the 80s, this guy was the prototype for getting juice. And there was a video that was released, and maybe one of you two guys will remember this, and it was late 80s or early 90s, and it was called the South's Bloodiest Battles. And it literally was all Tommy Rich matches taking place in high school gymnasiums where he's blading himself. But, I mean, like he's just been dipped in a pool of blood. He's just covered from head to toe. And to see him bleeding in this match, you know, it adds a dramatic effect to it. I love the fact that they're going all over the arena. I got really excited when they wound up at the concession stand. Unfortunately, there was no Tojo there. Nobody was throwing mustard on anybody else. But, you know, I'm always praying to see another concession stand brawl. And if you watch that match, and I don't know if either of you have seen that, but as they're at the concession stand, there's a little kid actually sitting on the countertop of the concession stand as this is all taking place. Ron Sexton was the referee. Ron Sexton was the guy that we saw in Florida working prelims in 1978. I think he was a Knoxville-based guy. And if I'm correct, he wound up working for the ICW and PAFO's organization for years. But really the highlight of this for me is when they get to the dressing room and the heels are in the dressing room and the baby faces are trying to get in and they stay there for about 2 minutes and they're just battling back and forth. And I just thought that was great. So again, this is the stuff that Memphis did so well. This is the stuff that I want to see. I think of Memphis. This is exactly what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, and you know you're so right about Tommy Rich. He's got these red tights on. His hair at one point in the match when they kind of it's I don't want to say it's clips, but obviously there's been some editing done. But they cut to a spot where Tommy's kind of leaning back into the corner. His hair is pink because his face is so red. His blood is just this is the if you look up Tommy Rich hits a gusher. This is probably going to be the match because he's just covered in blood. But you're right when they go back and they actually get to the exit door of the auditorium and it's the I guess it's the National Auditorium and he throws Norvell into the door and the door opens up and I'm thinking they're going to flat out take it out in the parking lot, which would really be awesome. But they kept it back in. And then they start heading. And what's funny was I think Tommy throws Norvell into the dressing room. Coco is still out working with Eddie. They're by the exit door. And they kind of Tommy had to go over and get Coco to bring him back to the dressing room and to get him back in there. Good fun stuff, though. I wanted to ask you, while we're on the subject of the PYTs, Barry, since you're everything Florida, tell me what you remember about the PYTs, because they had a pretty decent run in Florida. I want to say the latter part of 84, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think it was towards 84 going into early 85 and the PYTs came in. So we had seen Norvell Austin twice previously. He was in the early 70s, 72 with Sputnik Monroe, still kind of a green guy at that point. They held the Florida tag titles and then Norvell came back in 77 and he was working late 76, early 77 was working mostly prelims, getting some mid-card shots. But again, not a guy that's going to have a terrible match by any stretch. He's always solid. And then they came back 84-85, the PYTs. They aligned themselves with Percy Pringle the third. And they were fun. You know, these were two guys. And Coco wasn't a bad-looking guy, but nobody was ever going to call Norvell a pretty young thing. And that's obviously the irony of the name of the team. But they would come out with these red Michael Jackson Thriller type of jackets, and they had boom boxes, and they wore sunglasses. But they were a lot of fun to watch. And, you know, the mid-80s, I think, in Florida, yeah, it's kind of a downtime in a lot of ways. These guys were kind of one of the bright spots, I think.
Yeah, no, I had a lot of fun watching them. I remember they did an angle where they didn't they attack Dutch Mantell with a boombox or something like that on Florida television?
They did.
And Michael Jackson or Michael Hayes came out and he goes, "Gordon, this was a hit." You know, that's I think what led to the Percival Pringle the third character coming onto Florida. So Pete, why don't you talk a little about how much further after this match would have happened would the WFIA angle have taken place?
Well, there's a couple of things I was going to say about it. The team with Rich was actually Eddie's springboard to become a singles guy in Memphis. Like, he wasn't ever, you know, like, presented by himself before that. And, you know, I think in a way, like, you know, compare the Fabs to the New Fabs or whatever. New Fabs, they tried to get him over, saw it wasn't working, and they turned him. But it really, I think, Eddie got a rub from being around Tommy, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. As a matter of fact, there's a great interview segment that they did with Eddie right after the turn, where Eddie is sitting in a chair and he's going over all the reasons why the fans should support him and not Tommy. And he's talking about, oh, he's the international champion. He's too big a deal to be on just a little old Memphis TV. But I'm here for you, fans. And it's really pretty funny stuff of Eddie being Eddie.
Yeah, and when you know you look at the Fabs as well, just because I was thinking about when they actually went against the PYTs, because they did. I remember Stan Lane sitting there talking, you know, and there was a big difference. The Fabs, for lack of a better term, and I know, like, these days people look at those pictures and the videos and they're thinking they're maybe watching some sort of advertisement for gay porn or something, but Stan Lane would go and, you know, he'd talk about, you know, the blue smoke coming out of Norvell Austin's car and stuff like that, you know, and they were actually pretty cool, actually, back then. But going with what you're saying, this was the springboard for Eddie. And that's where he became, he won the title from Tommy shortly after the turn. And that was the springboard for his singles career, because he never had one in Memphis before that. And this is what pushed him up to, you know, being on the top of the card. I think it was a few months, to answer your question, because our thing was in the summer. And what'd you say? This was April or May?
Yeah, this was May. Yeah.
Yeah, so there you go. It's a couple months before. And
that angle too, with you and what was the other guy's name that you were with presenting the award to Gilbert and to Rich?
I can't remember the other guy's name. Hank or you know, something like that.
Harold.
I think it was Harold.
Jerry. I'll tell you. But
Howard Bowles. Absolutely. Yeah. But it was
good Lord, can you imagine if we didn't actually say his name? We'd all be getting phone calls from Howard Baum. How could you not say my name?
Hey, wait a minute. I'm still waiting for that phone call, brother. I'm not really sure I get one. But anyway, you know, to the point that when, just so you guys know, because that whole thing, the angle on TV wasn't planned out before I got there, okay? Because I was on Lawler's show the week before that with Eddie, and I've known Eddie forever. But Eddie, when we were there, there was a break between the TV show, the Live Memphis show, and Lawler's show. It was about an hour. So we're sitting in there, you know, in a different studio, and we're just hanging out. Like, Eddie and I are talking, Lawler's there, et cetera, et cetera. There's more to that story as well. But I was talking to Eddie, and that's where I said to him, hey, we're coming in at the WFIA, and we had the voting and all that junk. Why don't we make you guys tag team of the year? Because he was telling me what was going to happen. You know, he said 1 week this was going to happen. The next week, Hart was going to interfere, but he wasn't going to see it. The next week, he was going to win the title. You know, he kind of gave me a layout for about 3-4 weeks down the road. And that's how the whole thing started, as far as our angle goes. But as far as, like, him turning and the, you know, the push, it was coming. But, yeah, the angle, yeah, was my idea. But he and Eddie and I just talked about it. And I found out probably Thursday night, I think, that it was a go. He ran it by Jarrett and told me, you know, it was a go. But he told me not to tell anybody. So the funny thing is, Howard's sitting there. If you ever watch that, he has no idea what's going to happen. And, you know, all he was doing was trying to mug for the camera. Like, you could see there's like a video screen, so you could see when you're in camera range. So you'll see every now and again he's moving to make sure he's in the camera. But other than that, no one else knew what was happening.
Well, I can't
but it
believe
really
that,
did springboard Eddie.
I can't believe that Howard Baum would want to get himself over like that. That's just so unlike our friend Howard.
Well, it might not have been anything with the camera. It might have been just the usual of trying to see himself in the mirror. Who knows?
Well, so anyway, so to, once again, finally, to answer Travis Rain's questions, Pete Lederberg is the man that's responsible or should hold the blame for Barry Rose and myself meeting one another. This is way back in the late 80s, I want to say. And so, Peter, we really appreciate you being on this segment with us, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, guys. And anytime you need some comic relief or someone else to laugh at, maybe the same thing, I don't know, call me anytime, okay?
All right, folks.
See you, brother.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
All right. Take it easy.
And we want to thank my good friend Pete Lederberg, the man responsible, as we said, for introducing us. And I know there'll be hell to pay for that eventually down the road. So we're going to now take a look at our second match. We are going to go to July 23rd, 1984 in Tokyo. This is the UWF. And just so no one gets confused, this is not Bill Watts's UWF. This is the Universal Wrestling Federation from Japan. And what had happened was, Satoru Sayama, just for the uninitiated, was, of course, the very first Tiger Mask, the first and some would say the best. There's a matter of dispute, of course. But Sayama had had some money issues with the front office in New Japan. There were some disagreements professionally and personally, some financial problems going on there. So Sayama, Akira Maeda, Yoshiaki Fujiwara, Kazu Yamazaki, Nobuhiko Takada, and some of the other guys had decided to split off and form their own group. And it was basically under the auspice of the legendary Carl Gotch. Carl Gotch was one of the all-time great shooters in the history of professional wrestling. And was a guy that didn't like, shall we say, the showier aspects of professional wrestling. So he took these guys. This group was incredibly, incredibly popular within the Tokyo area. However, they had a problem because they had no television. They had a real problem drawing fans outside of the major media markets. So when they tried to go to the smaller towns, they were running into a lot of problems because, of course, they hadn't been able to penetrate into the markets with television. So it was strictly word of mouth. And, you know, they were trying to attract fans to a style that had never been seen by most of the Japanese wrestling fans. So they kind of fell on their face outside of the Tokyo area, but inside the Tokyo metropolitan area, they were incredibly popular. So Barry, you had a chance to watch Satoru Sayama and Nobuhiko Takada versus Akira Maeda and Yoshiaki Fujiwara. Tell me what you thought of this match.
So I'm such a huge fan of this match, and it's for several different reasons. One is there is a lot of grappling in this match. In the first 4 or 5 minutes, it's kind of the opening sequence between Takada and Fujiwara. They're wrestling. This is this back and forth kind of chain wrestling, grappling, and I just love the style. So I really enjoyed that too. Takada is a guy that I don't know if history has not been kind to him, but when I watch Takada, especially at this stage, which is kind of the earlier part of his career, I just see dollar signs. Physically, he had a look. There's a real resemblance to Jumbo Shiruta here as well. But I just think that Takada could have done anything. But, you know, in watching him, He's got this great style of this mixed shoot. You know, you can tell he's shooting at times. Other times he's grappling and he's working. He does this drop kick off the top rope onto Fujiwara. And, you know, we certainly have seen drop kicks, you know, off the top rope. And I think the first time I ever saw one was like Bill Dundee in the 70s. And it was through the magic of Beta Tape. Remember Beta Tape back in the day?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but so it was Bill Dundee doing it. But anyways, what Takada did, I don't know if I've ever seen a drop kick off the top rope like this. Fujiwara really does take most of the abuse during this match, but he executes this beautiful bridging belly-to-back suplex, kind of gets a surprise win. Sayama, too. Sayama's another guy that, you know, as Tiger Mask, obviously, you know, he's legendary at this point. But, you know, he does this tombstone pile driver, followed by this flying headbutt on Fujiwara from the top rope. And I swear to God, he's literally going about three quarters of the way across the ring. They actually do a slow-mo replay of it to show you. And he just springboards off the top rope, and he almost hits the other side of the ring. It's absolutely incredible. He's super impressive, though. He does this standing flip onto Maeda, followed by an arm lock. And then later in the match, he does a Pele kick. And this Pele kick now, obviously, you know, with AJ Styles, who's made it really popular between TNA, New Japan, and now the WWE. But this is the first time I ever saw a Pele kick that I can ever recall, going back to 84. So he looks great. So I really like this match. This is, you know, and I watched the UWF only because I thought it was revolutionary when it first came out. And there was a lot in the original UWF that I found extremely boring. And I think part of it was exactly what you just said. They really were not putting the showmanship into this. You know, this was Carl Gotch. This wasn't supposed to be flashy. This was supposed to be serious wrestling. And sometimes I think that was lost as far as translation for me. Not with this match. I loved it.
Yeah, this is I have to tell you, I think this is a really good match. I don't know that it's a top 100 match of the 80s. Now, that being said, there's another match that is in the top 100 from the UWF in the middle part of the 80s that we will discuss on another episode. But here's what it's not that I don't like the match. I think it's a really, really good match. I think it's a match that for the uninitiated, it's going to be a little bit harder to watch because, as you said, there's a lot of grappling, exchanging of holds. There's not a lot of high spots in this match. But what's funny is they spend so much of the match because of the influence of Gotch exchanging holds on the mat. There's these slaps that are just absolutely brutal to watch because they're slapping each other in the face. But in amongst all this, all of a sudden there's this spot where you get a pile driver, the flying headbutt, a snap suplex, and a missile dropkick from Takada. And it's so completely out of the realm of what they were doing in the early part of the match. It's like they went from this completely scientific UWF, almost like a Les Thornton match, for God's sakes, just to throw an old name out there, to all of a sudden, like in the last couple of minutes, they decided to go to Dynamite Kid, you know, that where they're doing all these incredible high spots. They go from this face buster into a power bomb. Like you said, you have the German suplex with Fujiwara, I believe, getting the pin on Takada. Match goes about 17 minutes. But I'll tell you what the best part of this match is. When you watch this match, watch the fans at ringside, because the people at ringside, and this, I believe, might have taken place in Korakuen Hall in Tokyo, they completely believe what they're watching. They yes. think this is a 100% shoot. They don't care that someone's doing a flying headbutt. I'm telling you, when this match starts and they come over and, you know, I say it's Satoru Sayama, just in case for anyone who watches the match. Obviously, he was Tiger Mask. He comes to the ring wearing the Tiger Mask, you know. He was called Super Tiger in the UWF, so he'll be the guy wearing the mask. So, but the crowd is just so you can almost watch the match and just enjoy the match viscerally by watching the reaction of the crowd, because they're, you know, they talk about silent heat, and you know, there's points where the crowd is just watching. It's like they're watching a college wrestling match, for God's sakes. They're so in tune to it, and then out of nowhere, you'll hear someone suddenly go, "Sayama!" or Maeda, and that's like the only interruption you have. But then when they go to the finish, you know, the crowd's popping so huge, but these UWF crowds were so intense and they were so loyal to it was like their promotion, you know, the Maniacs I discussed, the UWF Maniacs in Tokyo before, and they really were. And because they were so totally committed to this brand and this product that there just couldn't be any different. So, as Barry said, Nobuhiko Takada, you could see in this match, was going to be a star. And he was a guy, I really believe, that was going to be pushed by Inoki. If the plan, you know, Inoki and Sakaguchi, the leaders of New Japan, if the progression had advanced the way that it was supposed to have advanced, I think Takada would have ended up being a star on the level of Muto and Chono and Hashimoto, because he was really said that New Japan has a progress that they bring their younger guys up. They send them out to the United States or to Mexico for a few months, bring them back, and they're gradually elevated. And you could see the progression of Takada happening. So the third match we're going to talk about, it is from 1987, February 5th. It's available, unfortunately, not on YouTube. You have to get this one on New Japan World. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match. Why don't you tell the folks what you thought of the Takada Shiro Koshinaka match?
Yeah, too, and I think we should say too that for anybody possibly thinking about getting New Japan World, which is only, if I'm correct, $10 a month, be prepared to devote hundreds of hours in just getting lost in just watching the content on here. If you have a lot of free time, this is great. If you're like me, you got a lot going on in your life, something's got to give. So I'm giving up sleep, and I'm just going to watch New Japan World for the rest of my life because it's that good. So this is a cool match. Again, I'm a big Takada fan. You know, I look at him and I think, wow, this guy has dollar signs. He's got everything. There's not a I don't see a flaw in the game here. Physically looks great, and once he gets in the ring, he's tremendous. So I'm a big fan of Wood. So this is a really, really good match. You know, there's a great spot where Takada delivers this jumping back kick to Koshinaka, and Takada's in the ring, and Koshinaka's on the ring apron, and he knocks him off, and Koshinaka just flies back and takes this bump. And Takada's kicks, too, so we know that, you know, this is supposed to be a shoot, or it's not a shoot, it's a work shoot. At the same time, some of these kicks look devastating. There are points where you can tell he's definitely pulling back the kicks, and they're being worked, but some of them were definitely connecting, and you can hear it. So who is the ref here, and why does the ref look like he's Pele, which I've mentioned twice now in an episode? Was this Jerry Morrow?
You know what? It might have been, because this was not a guy that was a normal referee for New Japan. This was not the referee. Who's the referee? From the guy that worked Florida. Why am I drawing a complete blank?
Tiger Hattori.
Exactly. This was not Tiger Hattori. This was not the guy Pete, whose name was Petey, who was the other Japanese ref at this point in time. This was a guy that I'd never seen before. So, but Jerry Morrow did, in fact, work New Japan. Very well could have been him. You absolutely hit the nail on the head there.
Yeah, just but the resemblance to Pele, too, is just frightening. I was waiting for a Pele kick the entire time. We never got it. I think part of the dramatic aspect of this match, too, is Koshinaka gets popped in the mouth. And this isn't just your normal, a little blood around the lips. There's one point where he's face down on the mat and the blood is just pooling as it's coming out of his mouth. That definitely adds to the dramatic effect of this match. And then there's this sequence, which I just think, this is incredible. There's a sequence when they're on the mat and Takada has Koshinaka in some sort of a leg hold, and Koshinaka's bleeding from the mouth, and Shiro starts to slap Takada, and as he's slapping him, Takada's looking at him and he's saying something back to him in Japanese, and this goes on for maybe 20 or 30 seconds, and you can hear these slaps. These aren't these little baby slaps across the face. This is a full out, almost a punch with an open hand. It's an open-handed bitch slap, as they call it. I think it's great. And then they get to this sequence, and I am going to deflect this to you and let you pick up with this, but where Koshinaka starts working on Takata's fingers. And please, this is up to you now, Jeff.
So, you know, I watched this match, and I got to be honest with you. You know, we talk about matches that should be in the top 100 and should not be. We talked recently about the Bockwinkel-Hennig match, and I said that it probably belongs in the top 20. Upon reflection, I think this match may belong in the top 20. That's how good this match was. And I really think, boy, 1987 into early 1988, before he left for the reformation of the UWF, I think Nobuhiko Takada might have had 5 or 6 matches that I put in my top 100 of the decade. This guy was just on fire. But besides being an incredible pro wrestler, I'll put in quotation marks, he was also part of the UWF group, which had a reputation of being all shooters and things like that. So when he went into a match, the fans in New Japan, really much like the UWF fans, they believed that this guy was real. So Nobuhiko Takada went into the ring, and he was real. Shiro Koshinaka, the fans looked at him and said, oh, he's a really good pro wrestler, but he's not real. So here you had this match going on, and the sequence that Barry talked about is towards the end of the match, Koshinaka gets Takada down in an arm lock, and he has his fingers, and he begins working the breaking of Takada's fingers. And Takada is selling it so effectively that you believe that Koshinaka has, in fact, broke his fingers in the middle of this armbar. And they end up stopping the match. Spoiler alert, but it's a 30-year-old match, folks. They stop the match because Takada has conceded because his fingers have been broken. Now, you have to understand the context, and that's a word I use every week. The context of this is you have a guy that is basically perceived as being real, like a UFC guy submitting to a pro wrestler. A guy that's never been. Koshinaka was a fantastic pro wrestler, but no one ever thought of Koshinaka as a tough guy. His finisher, for God's sake, was Iceman King Parsons' butt. That's essentially what his finishing move was. But here he takes his guy, and they had a tremendous rivalry that went on for about a year and a half, these two. And here he is submitting to this quote unquote pro wrestler who's broken his fingers. This finish came out of nowhere and was so completely shocking to the New Japan fans at ringside, and especially to any old UWF fans that might have been in attendance. This is one of their heroes quitting and submitting to a pro wrestler. So it was just completely fantastic. The finishing sequence, the intensity in the crowd is just off the charts. It's even greater than the UWF match we mentioned previously.
I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
As we're talking about this, it's actually going to be twofold. It's a two-part question. And my second part is going to be a hypothetical, but was there any legitimate heat between Koshinaka and Takada? And I realize it's professional wrestling. The idea is to sell it. But as I'm watching Koshinaka slap Takada and the look on Takada's face, I'm saying, well, there's got to be some heat here between these two guys because they really were going at it.
Not that I've ever heard. That's just the fact that these two guys at this point were absolute superstars in the ring. And it's, you know, because of politics, they weren't put at the top of the cards. But at this point, and one of the great things they ended up doing, I don't know if it was in 86 or later in this year of 87, was in the New Japan Tag Team Tournament, when they were slotting people as tag teams, they ended up putting Koshinaka and Takada as a tag team, which made for a fascinating series of matches, because here you had these two guys that everyone knew were the bitterest of rivals, to the point where Barry thought there was legitimate heat between the two of them, and they made him a tag team. And the crazy thing is I remember Dave Meltzer writing that the way they worked for that 1 month tournament, they were the best tag team in the whole world. That's how good they were. So no, I don't think, to answer your question, I don't think there was any legitimate heat. I think they were just two guys that were really super professionals, off the chart wrestlers.
Gotcha. So the second part of my question this is the hypothetical as well. Had Takada not gone to the UWF and either stayed with New Japan or possibly jumped ship and gone to All Japan, where I think he would have been a tremendous fit, what would his standing have been in professional wrestling?
I think if he had stayed, he probably would have ended up being regarded as at least on the level of a Muto, Hashimoto, or Chono. That sort of legacy with New Japan. If he goes to All Japan, there's going to be a real political situation there, because you know you had your Misawa and Kawada already lined up, and that with that glass ceiling with Tenryu and Saruta, and then when Tenryu ends up leaving to go to the SWS promotion, the ceiling is raised and allows Misawa to come in there. But I don't think that the wrestling politics being what they were, that Takada would have been allowed. Yeah, I mean, he may have been the equal, if not even a little bit better than those guys, but the corporate ceiling there might have been very hard for him to get past. So I think if anything, he would have stayed in New Japan because he had already been slotted there, and he could have definitely, you know, they called Chono, Hashimoto, and Muto the Three Musketeers, and I think they could have made that a foursome because he was that talented and that believed by the fans, shall we say.
That's a great answer.
So, well, I like to think so. So, yeah. Couple things we're going to now switch or change midstream here. We are going to talk, Barry and I, as you know by now, if you listen to this show, we are big fans of movies. And one of the things that Barry and I both finds ourselves loving more than anything is a great dumb movie. Barry, I think I speak for both of us on that.
My God, my entire life revolves around dumb, what's considered bad and terrible movies. And when we were drawing up this list, and I got to say, I'm really excited about this, first off, because you know, besides wrestling, I think this is a discussion about probably my most favorite subject other than wrestling. But I have no idea, with the exception of one movie on your list, the other four are going to be a surprise to me. So my second surprise of the day, it's like my birthday's come a little bit early. But truthfully, every movie I watch, even my top 10, when we did the top 10 list some months back, I think 8 out of those movies would be considered B movies or bad films to some degree. These are the movies that I watch. So, you know, me going and taking a list, and I had a list of 40 films that I had to narrow down to 5. How do you do that? So I don't know. But anyways, I'm super excited, and I'm really excited to hear what your 5 choices were.
Now, let me just say, when we say these are bad movies, these are, and not all my movies, at least, I'm not sure about Barry's, they're not all movies that are like, you know, direct-to-videos. I would say arguably 4 of the 5 were actually – pretty mainstream releases, but they're so bad that you enjoy them. They're the kind of movie that you go to and you talk back at the screen because the dialogue is just so ridiculously hokey, sort of a Mystery Science 3000 kind of thing. You're throwing popcorn at the screen but you're reveling in the stupidity of the movie. And that was the basic plot that I gave Barry. I said, come up with some movies that people enjoy, while at the same time realizing that we're not talking The Godfather here, folks. These are movies that are good movies to some, but they've got quite a bit of stupidity to them. I got to be honest with you, and this is a good way for me to get heat with my co-host. When I came up with my original list, Roadhouse may have been on the list. I got to be honest with you, Barry. But
deny that, though. I would absolutely agree. Again, if you go through either my guy movies, my favorite movies, the movies we're doing today, they're all the same exact fucking genre. Roadhouse is a terrible movie, but yes. I love it.
And, you know, Swayze, God bless him and his hair. But anyway, why don't we start, Barry? We're going to do our top 5 great dumb movies. Give me your number 5, Barry.
Okay. She's an honor student by day and a Hollywood hooker by night with a killer on the loose. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to 1984's Angel. And Jeff, I don't know if you've ever seen Angel, but Angel is a New World release. It was literally a 15-year-old girl named Molly is this A student. She's fantastic at school, and nobody suspects that this model student earns her money at night by being a hooker on Sunset Boulevard and Hollywood Boulevard in California. So it's such a great movie. It's so cheesy. It's sleazy in its own way. Is it believable? Not really. The girl playing 15-year-old Molly is cute, but she's really 25. This was Donna Wilkes. And Donna Wilkes was somebody that I think when this movie came out, she was kind of positioned that, you know, this could be kind of a breakout star. Well, didn't really work out that way. I think she made 2 or 3 movies after this. She wasn't in the other Angel movies, apparently had extracurricular activities going on in her life that kind of derailed her career. She had actually been on the television show Hello Larry with the beautiful Kim Richards and McLean Stevenson for MASH, and she was booted after the first season. Rumor is these issues had kind of taken over and had to get her off. But this movie is great. There's this whole subplot. Again, she's this high school hooker, but there's this subplot where she sees a serial killer. She's an eyewitness to one of the murders, and then he comes after her, and she's kind of taken in with all of these other characters on Hollywood Boulevard. And if you've ever been out to Hollywood Boulevard, You need to get a hepatitis shot before you walk the streets of Hollywood. And I lived out there in the mid-80s. And it's worse now, but there used to be all these really freakish, unusual characters. So somehow the movies exaggerated that. You've got Rory Calhoun, who was a big star in the 40s and 50s. He was a cowboy star. He's relegated now to playing this aging cowboy on Hollywood Boulevard. Dick Shawn is a guy who, there's such a great legacy here. He was a guy that was in the movie The Producers, It's a Mad, Mad World. You know him from TV. He did Password, The Love Boat, Three's Company, Laverne and Shirley. He was on all these shows, probably Mannix and all the ones you and I always talk about. Well, he's playing a drag queen here, and he's a fatherly influence. And there's a great Dick Shawn story. So Dick Shawn was this guy that would actually go, he was basically a stand-up comedian and would do this act and was known for doing pratfalls and was really, he described it as having a love affair with his audience. So in 1987, he's doing a show somewhere around the San Diego, La Jolla area in California. And it turns out he's having a heart attack, and he's dying on stage. And he had instructed all the stagehands to never come out because he would do these crazy things. For 5 minutes, the guy stayed on stage dying of a heart attack, and nobody went out to assist him because they thought it was part of the show. This is such a good movie. John Deal, who you know from Miami Vice and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and probably a million other movies, Falling Down with Michael Douglas. Stripes. Exactly. John Deal is in this movie. He plays the killer, who's a necrophiliac. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. So if you've never seen Angel, it is everything that you want from your 1980s, your mid-1980s cheese fest. This is the movie you want to see.
I'm going to dispute that later in my list. But I will add this. Donna Wilkes was one of the kids in Jaws 2, if I'm not mistaken, that went out on the boats that were chased by the shark. And you mentioned Rory Calhoun. Rory Calhoun, also well known for what early 80s horror classic?
Oh, my God.
Motel Hell!
It takes all kinds of critters to make Farmer Vincent's fritters. And, oh, my God, is Motel Hell another fantastic movie that did not make my top five, but I could watch that 7 days a week if I had to.
Great one. So we're going to go to my number five. My number five came out, I recall, about April of 1983. The plot summary goes as follows. A Pittsburgh woman with two jobs as a welder and an exotic dancer wants to get into ballet school. Folks, it's Flashdance, starring the great Jennifer Beals, who was absolutely a complete knockout in this film. But I have to tell you something. Her character is so unlikable. She's such a bitch in this movie that you can't believe that Michael Norrie's rich guy character ever falls for her, other than the fact that she's just smoking. Let's put it this way. You can believe that he falls for you. You just can't believe that he stays with her. But this movie is, she works as a stripper at a club where they don't take their clothes off. So I can imagine tons of guys wanting to go to that place. Let me tell you something. Please tell me you've seen this classic.
Yeah, and I hate this fucking movie, too. I got to tell you, there's nothing here that I would ever watch other than Jennifer Beals. And Jeff, if I can digress as I normally do 50 times per episode. So Jennifer Beals came into my restaurant in New York City once.
I've never heard that before, Barry. Go ahead.
She came in. She had a young child at this point, and she came in on a fairly regular basis. And it was only on Saturday or Sunday we would see her, and she would come in, and she was really friendly, really strikingly drop-dead gorgeous in person, but very unaffected by any sort of fame that she had encountered from Hollywood. So I think the biggest thing to come out of this movie, you're right, too, a strip club where they don't take off their clothes, I guess that makes sense, but the soundtrack for this was really, this had to be one of the number one, you know, album releases of 1983, if not number one. And was it Maniac by Michael Cimbello? And whatever happened to that guy?
I don't know, but I'm just going to mention that the name Michael Cimbello may be coming up yet again in this episode
for reasons
that I will get into that I'm going to keep from my co-host. My co-host now is going to give you his number four bad movie of the decade.
Sure. So my number four bad movie of the decade. So here's a movie, and when I say this too, I love this movie, and I'm definitely going to tell you why I love this movie. And it's not bad as in it's so bad I love it. It's just a lot of people look at it and go, you really like this movie? And it's 1985's Summer Rental with John Candy. So in a brief synopsis, John Candy is this overworked, hasn't been on a vacation in like 15 or 20 years since his honeymoon. He's an air traffic controller, and he's having basically a breakdown on the job. And he loses a plane one day, and he's freaking out, and it turns out a fly's land on his screen. So his boss, who is gives him off a mandatory like a month, and he gets him a house down in the fictitious Gulf Coast resort town of Citrus Clove, Florida, which is really, I guess, the St. Petersburg area. And it's basically all the mishaps that could occur. They get down there, and they go to the wrong house, and it's this amazing house. They get kicked out in the middle of the night. They wind up staying at this really shitty beach shack directly on the beach, but it's like the public access for everyone to go through there. So, you know, a lot of stuff goes down here. He gets his rival is this guy named Captain Al Pellet, played by Richard Crenna from Rambo fame and a million other movies. And Captain Al is this obnoxious asshole who wins the regatta every year. So as it turns out, the landlord of this beach shack dies, and Captain Al Pellet is the new landlord. So he makes a bet with John Candy's character, Jack Chester, that if Jack Chester can win the regatta, he can stay in the house. And of course, you know, it's one of these movies where it's kind of got the Rocky theme. The underdog comes through at the end, and the Jack Chester and his family wind up winning the regatta and they can stay. But the star of this movie to me is Rip Torn, and Rip Torn plays Scully. Apologies. It's Captain Scully, and he's this pirate kind of guy. He runs his own bar. He gives sailing lessons. He's got this great eyes, Scully. He's got this whole pirate thing going down. But you know, we talk about the great character actors of all time, and we always bring them up. And Rip Torn, I could watch Rip Torn in like a tampon commercial. He is so good. He is a guy that his delivery of his lines, you know, I used to watch the Larry Sanders Show, which was a great show. But at the same time, I watched it for Rip. He is so good. So I love this movie. I've seen it a million times. I love the fact that it all takes place at a beachfront community. I spend a lot of time down in that area. That's kind of the Tampa area, Anna Maria, where I'm at. I will say Carl Reiner actually directed this movie, and Carl Reiner has directed another movie that I love, which is Summer School, which did not make my top five list, but it's certainly in the top 20.
Starring the great Mark Harmon.
You know, you watch Summer School and you go, why didn't Mark Harmon have a bigger film career? Certainly on television, you know, the guy, he's been, what is it,
NCIS.
Yes, okay. I don't know. I get all confused. But Mark Harmon, I love Summer School with Chainsaw and Dave. I just think that's such a great movie. But Rotten Tomatoes gave this 14%. IMDb gave it 6.2 out of 10. On the Barry Rose scale, we're looking 10 out of 10 on this one.
I think what I remember about this movie is it's fun watching Dan Aykroyd basically play a heel character. And he was
absolutely
a lot of fun.
I don't know what fucking movie you're talking about, but yeah, it would be great if Dan Aykroyd was in this movie.
I'm thinking of the great.
So what happened? In my head, I figured, okay, John Candy goes to the beach. John Candy goes to the lake. What's going to happen next? They're going to do all these movies. Now, The Great Outdoors is another movie that could have made my top five, and it just bubbled. It's in my top 10, though, because I love it. And Dan Aykroyd did play this kind of heel character in that movie. And I love that movie.
And that's my mea culpa. I confuse the movies. So put one down against me. So I'm going to go for my number four, which came out in 1997. Here's our plot summary, Barry. Humans in a fascist, militaristic future do battles with giant alien bugs in a fight for survival. Tell me what the name of the movie is.
Uh,
How about if I give you a clue? Casper Van Dien and Denise Richards.
Yeah, and I got it. They're like giant spiders. What the fuck? Starship.
Starship Troopers, my
Starship
friend.
Starship Troopers.
Oh my God! And you know, if for no other reason, it's got one of the great quotes in the history of cinema, when the sergeant, I believe, tells the guys, "He's the bugs are eating his brain." This movie is just an absolute hoot because it's so over the top. But much like another one of Barry's favorite movies, RoboCop, there's this underlying sense of humor to the film that really just makes it so much fun. That you know, they're really. It's a science fiction film where they're trying to kill all these bugs. You got characters with name like Johnny Rico. And it's just a stinking hoot. You've watched this movie, of course, I'm sure.
I have. And so you bring up a really good point there. If you're going to have a movie and it's going to be really cheesy, names like Johnny Rico are mandatory. You've got to have those kind of names. So, yeah, when you said, and in my head, you described it perfectly. I'm going, what's the name of this movie again? Was Denise Richards in this movie?
Yes. Yeah, back when she was really hot.
Yeah, exactly. She didn't have the mustache at that point. She was really hot. She wasn't tainted by Charlie Sheen also. Sure. So I like this movie. Casper Van Dien was another guy that I think had been on one of the nighttime soap operas, like a Melrose Place or one of those shows, and he was positioned to be a big star. And for whatever reason, good-looking guy, model looks. But in this movie, this movie is a lot of fun, though. Like, you could watch this movie. You will not be bored. You know, the creatures are like these giant spiders, kind of crab-like spiders. I've seen it a bunch of times.
Great quotes like, shoot a nuke down a bug hole, you get a lot of dead bugs. And what's great is, it's funny because you have Doogie Howser, Neil Patrick Harris, who plays this kind of quasi-SS officer. He's dressed completely in leather, and he's the head of like the SS squad there, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it. But beyond all that,
right?
What's that?
He looks about 12 years old in that film, right?
He still looks like he's a preteen. But it's great because, much like RoboCop, you have these commercials where they're trying to get people to join the Army. And they're so tongue-in-cheek and so sarcastic that in the middle of killing all these bugs, it's just this hilarious ads that pop up from every now and again. And it's a really fun, stupid movie, which definitely fits the criteria of what we're talking about here. Okay, Barry, number three, let us have it.
Number three, 1985. This was the only film. So we posted on Facebook in the Breaking Kayfabe with Badger and Barry in the group yesterday that we were going to be doing this, and only one person was able to name a film on my top five list, and that was Kevin Carter, who brought up The Last Dragon. The Last Dragon with Shownuff. So I don't know if you've ever seen this movie. I don't know if you've ever heard of this movie. It was produced, financed by Berry Gordy of Motown Detroit fame. But it's basically the story of Leroy Green, who is played by the world-famous actor Timac, who I don't believe ever did much after this movie. But it's basically a young martial artist living in New York. He's training tirelessly. His idol is Bruce Lee. He wants to be Bruce Lee. He lives by the Bruce Lee principles. And one night, his entire life changes forever. He is walking down the street, and he rescues a television personality played by the lovely Vanity. And I can talk about Vanity for the next 6 hours. And he's rescuing her from this evil businessman who is trying to kidnap her because he wants to get his girlfriend's music played on her show. As it turns out, Leroy basically rescues her, and then this evil businessman hires this gang leader, and it's a guy, his name is Shownuff, which is fantastic, played by Julius J. Carey III. He's the self-styled Shogun of Harlem. So there's a lot of music in here. Vanity has a song or two in here. But the real star of this is, is this guy Shownuff? And every time he says Leroy's name, it's Leroy, which is great. And Shownuff just steals this movie. So have you ever seen, you've seen this movie, because I think everybody's seen this movie at least once.
I have not, I'm sad to admit, but I will ask you a question, Barry. I've never seen it. Let me throw this question out you. Hottest former girlfriend of Prince? You're going Vanity, Sheila E., or Apollonia?
So, well, and it's amazing you said that. So I'm going to take Sheila E. out of the equation, and I would put her at number three, but that's not to discount her because she's smoking hot. Vanity or Apollonia? I'm going to say this. Are we doing an F. Mary Kill situation?
Sure, go ahead.
Let's do an F. Mary Kill. I'm going to kill Sheila E., which I feel terrible. She's a talented drummer, and she's stunningly beautiful. I am going to F... God, I hope my wife isn't listening to this show. What is your father this week, Jeff?
Say nothing of my parents, probably wondering.
Exactly. I'm going to F Vanity, but I'm going to marry Apollonia because I would want to F Apollonia more than once. So Apollonia to me, I look at her and I just say, oh, my God. And I think part of it was not only beautiful, but her body and her physique was absolutely incredible. Where I don't know if Vanity actually had that. Vanity certainly, from a facial, you know, nobody's more beautiful than Vanity. But Apollonia was really sexy. So that's an excellent question, by the way.
Well, I like to think. Yeah. So, all right, yeah. I'm going to.
What were we talking about again?
I can't remember.
I don't know. Let's just talk about Vanity and Apollonia. Yeah, absolutely,
I'm just
too.
Trying to figure out how I'm going to explain that sequence to my parents if they listen. So my number three film, I'm going back to 1983. Here is our plot summary. It should be pretty easy for you to figure out, Mr. Rose. It's 5 years later, and Tony Manero's Saturday Night Fever is still burning.
That's an easy one. Staying Alive, baby.
Staying Alive is one of the greatest dumb movies ever. It got a solid 4.5 on the IMDb scale, which basically puts it right in the shitter. I mean, this is one of the great – and the funny thing is – you know, Travolta's made so many good films. I mean, I'm the first one to tell you that. But he has made some completely horrible movies, too. And dare I say, we may be getting back to Mr. Travolta on my list and another one of his films. But this one, he's playing Tony Manero, who was so good in Saturday Night Fever. Whether you like disco or not, it was a great story. And, you know, great movie. If you're into disco, that's the ultimate soundtrack to get the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. But in this one, he's going back and he wants to get a job dancing on Broadway. And I will have to tell you, Barry, first of all, you, of course, have seen this film.
I have.
The play that he's auditioning for, I believe, is called something like Satan's Alley. Am I close on that? Do you remember?
I don't remember. Okay. You're probably right, though, but I don't remember.
It would have to have been, if it actually was released on Broadway, a candidate for the single worst Broadway production ever, because that you can just tell when you're watching this, oh, my God, this is going to make one horrible play or musical if they ever do. This thing wouldn't be released. It would have escaped. But besides Travolta, it stars Cynthia Rhodes, who ended up marrying, Richard Marx.
Richard Marx.
And just was absolutely gorgeous. She was also in, I hate when I draw blank on the Swayze films. Nobody Puts Baby in a Corner.
Wasn't Cynthia Rhodes in Flashdance too?
No. Yes, she was, as a matter of fact. Oh,
yeah,
Cynthia's making two appearances. But what's Nobody Puts Baby in the Corner? Why can't I remember this film?
Dirty Dancing.
Yes, she was the girl that got pregnant that Patrick Swayze helped in that film. But she is so beautiful in this movie, and this movie has more of a dare I say an early '80s Bee Gees vibe. It also has a song by the great musician Frank Stallone, which tells you all you need to know about this movie. It's got this actress named Finola Hughes who. And the only reason I know this is because my ex-wife used to watch this show, had like a 10-year run on General Hospital, but she was a really hot British chick in this movie. But wow, is this movie spectacularly bad, as Travolta plays this sort of Brooklyn-born goof who tries to hook up with this really snooty English actress, and it's just completely unbelievable. The dance sequences are horrible. But Cynthia Rhodes is absolutely gorgeous in this movie, and it's just so much fun watching Travolta try to appear cultured as Tony Manero. So, yeah, I never miss a chance to watch this movie because I sit there and just roar with laughter at how stupid it is. So, all right, Barry, number two, what's your film?
So how many more Travolta films are on your list?
One. So
what was that?
I want our listeners right now to sit there while you're listening to this podcast and go, okay, which Travolta film is he going to mention?
All right, I'm not going to mention one that I'm thinking of because I know it's not this one. We'll talk. I'll come back to this. So just scrap all this. I'll come right back to this. So my number two film is a movie, 1985, called Gotcha, starring Linda Fiorentino and Anthony Edwards from ER as Jonathan Moore. Have you ever seen this film?
I actually have.
You're speechless.
That's a good film.
Okay, so you have. So it's a good it's not. I love this movie, but let's be honest, this is not really a good film, and the reviews for it were not good.
It's a good stupid film, let's put it that way.
Absolutely. So here's the thing, is you watch this movie, and I showed this to my son about a year ago. This is one of those movies that we put in the category of you could never make this movie today. This movie is about a game called Gotcha, and there was a very popular game in the late 70s and early 80s called either Tag or The Assassination Game, which is actually a whole nother movie. But it was a game that was actually played on college campuses where people would shoot each other with paint guns, and they would say either gotcha or, you've just been assassinated. But they would actually chase each other around these college campuses with guns. And the opening sequence of this movie is Jonathan Moore is basically this college freshman that is kind of a loser. He can't get a date. He's asking out girls, and they completely rebuff him. They want nothing to do with him. But when it comes to Gotcha, he's like the man. He's got it down. But the opening sequence, there are people chasing each other all throughout this campus with guns, going through the schools and everything. Imagine trying to do something like that today. So obviously you can't. So in a nutshell, Jonathan is kind of down on himself. He can't get a date. He's got no luck with women. And his good friend Manolo, who is actually able to score with the ladies, is going over to Europe, and they decide to go over together. While he's over there, Jonathan meets Sasha Banachek, who is from she's a sexy Czech woman, played by the stunning Linda Fiorentino, another one that's just absolutely beautiful. And they're supposed to go off somewhere. I think he meets her in France, and he follows her to West Berlin. And as it turns out, when they're in West Berlin, they have to go over and they have to cross over into East Berlin. And he doesn't really know that. And, East Berlin at that time, this is before the wall came down. So he goes over with her. She gets a package. And unknowns to him, she actually hides the roll of film on him. He loses her. He comes back to America, and I got to say, one of the great sequences of any movie is when he's trying to cross the border of East Berlin into West Berlin, and it's just so much fun. He comes back to America. People are chasing him now. He's not really sure why. He goes to, it's either the FBI, I guess it's the FBI. He goes to one of the government agencies, and as he's in there to tell them what's going on, he spots Sasha Banachek. Turns out she's a CIA operative, and she had completely played him. So he's now being chased by all these killers all throughout Los Angeles, which really, they're all like these, Eastern European, Russian, and German killers who are an American now to kill him, and he winds up getting saved by Sasha Banachek, and he's saved. That's the way the movie ends. So does it make a lot of sense? It really doesn't. Is it anything that, the whole thing, none of it makes any sense. On that note, I think at some point in our lives, we could all identify with this guy, this Jonathan Moore, a guy that just wants to be able to score with the ladies. And when he finally scores with not just a lady, but it's Linda Fiorentino, I think we're all pulling for him. So I must have seen this movie. Geez, I saw it in the theaters when I lived out in Los Angeles in 1985, but I probably have seen it another 100 times since. It's a movie I can put on at midnight. I can watch part of it and fall asleep to it. Just a lot of fun to me.
Now let's go with pop culture references here. You said the female character's name was Sasha Banachek. Name the actor who played a detective in the 70s show Banachek. Boom, go.
Oh, shit. The father from A Christmas Story, right?
Nope. The great George Peppard. No. You lost. So
I would not have. I wouldn't have come up with that one. That's pretty good, though.
Thank you. My number two. Barry and I were talking this morning about a movie that, you know, when you think about great bad movies, I seriously had not seen this movie for almost 25 or 30 years. I pulled it up on YouTube and I started watching it today. And I texted Barry and I said, good Lord, is this a bad movie? And I don't mean that as strange as it sounds, in a bad way, because bad movies have, you know, Joe Bob Briggs, Barry, I know you read his stuff. He made a whole career out of watching and enjoying bad movies. So this plot summary begins as such. The new kid in school must battle a gang of street toughs after stealing the gang leader's girl. You brought up a great cheesy 80s teen movie from 1985, Barry. I'm talking Tough Turf. Tough Turf with the great James Spader, who, how did this guy go bald? Because, you know, you were talking about Anthony Edwards. If you look at the head of hair that he had in the movie you were talking about, how did these guys go bald? Because they just have this magnificent Swayze-esque, dare I say, hair that they somehow lose. So in this movie, he plays the snooty kid from Connecticut whose father has lost his job, is forced to move. He must have really taken a financial hit because he moves to this really sketchy part of L.A., where he goes to the high school that apparently is run, even though there's a security guard out there, there is a gang of kids who basically commit assault right in front of the security guard. That doesn't, he's just worried about people riding bikes on the school campus. But he sees the beautiful Kim Richards. Now, when I say the beautiful Kim Richards, I'm not talking about the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, drunken stupor, multi-plastic surgery Kim Richards, who's got the Kardashian taint on her because somehow she's affiliated with the Kardashians. This was drop dead, I mean to tell you, smoking gorgeous mid-80s Kim Richards, who was beautiful, but unfortunately at the time she was the girlfriend of Nick Hauser, the local tough guy, who, by the way, when this film was made, was apparently a high school student, even though the actor was 30 years old. I haven't seen such a disparity since Grease, when they had all those people in Grease were like in their early 30s making that movie as high school kids. So I find it interesting in this movie Tough Turf. And, you know, the new kid who kind of comes from a rich background is trying to get the bad guy's girl, even though there's absolutely literally other than the fact that she's drop dead gorgeous. Everything in this movie tells this guy, stay away from this woman. And he keeps going after her. The bad guy, Barry and I, we discussed, he was not up to snuff. Barry, why don't you tell us what I mean by that?
Yeah, so I got to say, too, this is one of my favorite movies of all time. I knew this was on your list. If it was not on your list, this might have been my number one choice. So I am thrilled that you put it on there. The bad guy sucked. And, you know, there's so much about this movie that I think the opening sequence is great. You know, he's bebop-a-lula, she's my, and he's riding his bike. Kim Richards, oh, my God. So I mentioned Kim Richards a few minutes ago with Hello, Larry, where they were both in she and Donna Wilkes were both in Hello, Larry. If there was anybody that was on a wholesome level as well, more beautiful than Kim Richards in 1984, I'm unaware of who that was. And as you said, she certainly has skankified herself between the alcohol and the arrests over the years, and she's just a mess. But my God, she is, you watch her in this movie and you go, this is what it's supposed to be. It's perfection. This movie is so good.
I'll tell you what's interesting about the way her character changes is, you know, for a large majority of the film, she's got the kind of slutty gangster's girlfriend look. She's got her hair all, ironed out or whatever. She wears the really, you know, skanky outfits, but skanky, but hot. But then there's a scene where she comes over to have dinner with Spader and his parents, which is just hilarious.
Yep.
But she kind of dresses like a normal high school girl, and she still looks drop dead beautiful. But, you know, it's such a funny movie. There's a, you know, Barry alluded to it earlier. There's a scene early in the movie where the bad guys basically run over James Spader's bicycle as a way of getting back for something he had done earlier in the movie. Okay. So he goes to his mom and he shows his mom the bike, and the bike has been run over. So it's just in pieces. And the mom says, your bike is in pieces and you tell me nothing happened. Do you at least find out if they have any insurance? And he says, Mom, this is not Connecticut. They don't have insurance around here. And so, you know, his dad is played by, oh God, I forget them. I've got to look up the guy's name now. Matt Clark. Matt Clark is one of those guys who was always in the Burt Reynolds films of the late 70s and early 80s. Really, really solid character actor. But they end up shooting, the bad guys shoot Matt Clark, okay, who's playing James Spader's father. And yet James Spader forgives the girl for being part of the group that shot his father and put him in the ICU. And then, of course, as I texted Barry earlier, there's a great scene where his father's in ICU. He's on a breathing apparatus. He may die. The girl comes over to see Spader, and Spader has to nail her. I texted Barry. I said, yeah, dad's in ICU, but Spader's still getting him a piece.
And my response was, a man has to have his priorities.
Exactly.
It's Kim Richards, for crying out loud.
Exactly,
you know, this movie, you throw in the fact that you've got Robert Downey Jr. in his first role. It's like his breakout role. He kind of steals the movie. He's this great. He plays the sidekick of James Spader's character. Spader being the new kid, Downey's the kind of, he kind of takes him in and they become friends. But you've got the Jim Carroll band. Those are people who've died. You've got them performing live in this movie. I have a great James Spader story if you want to hear it.
Well, before you do,
and start off the way that most of my stories do. So
I'll tell you.
So Spader,
say. Let me just put out. You mentioned Jim Carroll band. There was also performances by Jack Mack and the Heart Attack, who are just a tremendous R&B band. And there's a tremendous sequence with them at a club with Jack Mack and the Heart Attack. But also what's funny about the appearance of the Jim Carroll band is that Robert Downey Jr. is playing drums with the Jim Carroll band.
It well, if I recall correctly, and looking like he's having the best time ever.
So anyway, please tell your story.
Absolutely. So Spader was kind of this underground movie kind of hero. He made this movie. He made The New Kids within a few months of this, which were both produced by New World Films. And they were kind of pushing Spader to be like this star. So they signed him on. He made two or three films with them. He made a film in 86 called Jack's Back, and it was about a modern day Jack the Ripper. So he had three films under his belt, and he was kind of cool. He kind of had this vibe to him that was kind of cool. And I was living in New York in 86, and my girlfriend and I were walking down the street one day, and we were on Madison Avenue around 70th Street, somewhere around there, and Spader was leaning up against his car, and it looked like he was waiting for his girlfriend who was using getting money from the bank. And we looked, and he was wearing sunglasses, and I said, you know, and we had seen these movies together. I'm like, that's James Spader. And she goes, that's James Spader. Holy shit. And then she goes, what's that on his face? And I look, and I said, I think James Spader has fucking herpes all over his mouth. So that's pretty much the story. That's kind of the payoff with that one right there. James Spader may have had herpes in 86. So allegedly in 86.
As the original host of Breaking Kayfabe, let me just emphasize that Barry said allegedly, because certainly no legal action would want to be taken against this podcast for saying allegedly.
Exactly. But it certainly looked like, and at that moment, I think my love affair with James Spader died just a little bit. But for me, he'll always be the kid from Tough Turf and then The New Kids. And The New Kids was interesting also. I'm sure you've seen that one, because he flipped roles. He became the heel in The New Kids.
I did not see that one. I did see Jack's Back, though. That was good. And you know what's great about Spader in this is he plays sort of a almost James Dean character, where he's always wearing the sunglasses. He's got the leather jacket on. It's L.A. I mean, why do you need a leather jacket? It's not that cold. But he's just trying to portray himself as Billy Badass. He's the guy that's reading these in-depth great novels. He passes them on to the Kim Richards character. Oh, tell me what you thought about this. This was such a deep novel. He's trying to bring her up from her status as the poor daughter of the guy that owns the liquor store that has the apartment above the liquor store. I didn't even get to that, which is another whole thing. I literally, Barry said, we could do an entire episode just on how bad Tough Turf is. Barry, give me your
number. Great Tough Turf was.
Yes.
Absolutely.
The great, give me your number one dumb movie of all time.
So my number one film of all time is Blackula. And I consider myself kind of an expert. I don't know if expert, that sounds so pretentious and kind of an asshole thing to say, but I love the quote-unquote blaxploitation movies. And whether it's the Blackula series, whether it is the Coffee series, one of my favorites is a movie called Abby, which is kind of like the Black Exorcist. But Blackula is this tremendous movie, and it stars this guy named William Marshall. In a little context, William Marshall was a classically trained Shakespearean actor, having played in productions of Othello at least 6 times. So he wasn't this goofball off the street. Here was a Shakespearean-trained actor, and he's playing a character, an African prince with the greatest name ever, Mama Waldi. And he gets turned into a vampire by Count Dracula, and then gets sealed in a coffin for several hundred years. He reawakens in the 1970s in Los Angeles, and now he's leaving a trail of victims in his wake. But he pursues this girl named Lena, who is the spitting image of his dead wife, which really makes sense because the actress Vanetta McKee, she portrayed his dead wife and is portraying Lena. And Vanetta McKee also, I should say, was also in Repo Man, which is my favorite movie of all time. Anyways, Dr. Gordon Thomas, played by another great character actor named Thalmas Razulala, and the top cop is Gordon Pinsent. They're hot on his trail. And this movie, to me, encompasses everything that I want when I want to sit down and be entertained. This is not high art. Even though the actor is, again, probably better. I've often called William Marshall the best actor that nobody's ever heard of, because he elevates this movie from just going from pure trash up to another level. And I'm not sure what the other level is, but he's such a solid actor. And you may know him, actually. William Marshall, besides doing Blackula and Scream, Blackula Scream, which was the part two, essentially, with this. He was also, in later years, played the king of cartoons on Pee-wee's Playhouse. There was another actor named Gilbert Lewis who did it, and I believe he passed away, and something happened, and William Marshall actually took over. And I don't know if you ever watched Pee-wee's Playhouse, which I loved Pee-wee's Playhouse, but the character's catchphrase was, "Let the cartoon begin," and it was really popular back in the mid-80s. So this is such a good movie. There are so many good scenes. There's an actor named Elijah Cook Jr. Are you familiar with him at all?
Oh, sure. He was in tons of great noir.
Exactly. So this is towards the tail end of his career, and I think he's getting a payday on this one, which couldn't have been too much. And Elijah Cook Jr. plays a guy who's working in the morgue, and he only has one hand, and he's got a hook. And he gets attacked by one of the bodies, who turns out was a vampire, and it's this raging, screaming woman. And it's so campy. It's so cheesy. It's so much fun to watch it. So I can't, you know, for me, again, you know, I was sitting here tossing around, and Daniel Balderson, who's one of our great listeners and always contributes to our page as well. So we were discussing Jack Hill films, and he's bringing up a couple of films, and I just watched one of Jack Hill's films, and Jack Hill is the director who made Blackula, and with the success of this movie, he then made 20-something odd blaxploitation movies. He made a great movie called Spider Baby in 1967 with Lon Chaney Jr., also at the very tail end of his career. And I really had a hard time. Am I going to go Spider Baby? Will I go Blackula? Will I do Abby or will I do Coffee? And I wound up going with Blackula because, hey, I just saw it like 2 weeks ago. And William Marshall, I'm telling you, it wasn't fair. This guy should have been a bigger star because he was that good. Have you ever seen Blackula?
I have not, I'm ashamed to say.
Well, okay, for Christmas, I'll get you Blackula.
Yeah, I'll put that on my bucket list of films to watch. So now, Barry, it's time for my number one favorite dumb movie of all time. I've told you that it stars Travolta. Just go ahead, throw out a guess, because all those people right now are going, which Travolta film is it? Which one is it? No, it might be that one. No, it could be this one. What's your choice?
All right, I'm going to say it was the one. What was the one where he played a physical dance teacher? What was that shit called? Aerobics? He was like an aerobics teacher in 1985. What was that called? Do you remember that movie?
I can't remember the title, but I know the one you're talking about. That was not just a good, bad movie. That was a bad, bad movie. I think Jamie Lee,
right.
Jamie Lee Curtis Jamie was in Lee that. Right? Yes, yeah.
So, yeah, you're right.
No, no. My favorite bad movie of all time, which stars John Travolta, the second one on my list, the synopsis of the film goes, Bud is a young man from the country who learns about life and love in a Houston bar. Folks, it is the 1980 classic bad movie, Urban Cowboy. Urban Cowboy is so awesomely bad for so many reasons. First of all, it started the whole country rock, country pop genre in the early 80s, which led to some really good songs, also led to some really bad songs. This movie, one of the reasons I find this movie so awesomely bad and entertaining is when you look back on it, with the exception of the character played by Madeline Smith, who, by the way, was drop-dead gorgeous in this, of Pam, the rest of the people in the film are completely unlikable. Think about it. John Travolta's character of Bud and Deborah Winger's character of Sissy or Sissy are... There's no reason why these two should be a couple, because they fight each other like they're so immature. And then, of course, the one bright spot of the movie, besides how good Madeline Smith looks, I will tell you, in this stinker of a movie that I enjoyed so much, Scott Glenn as the legendary Wes Hightower, to me, is one of my favorite movie villains of all time, because he's such a piece of dirt in this film. And I'm not even kidding, even though I consider this a bad movie, I really think Scott Glenn should have gotten some sort of Oscar talk. That's how good I think he was in this film as the evil, villainous, just released from prison, Wes Hightower, the rodeo cowboy. And I literally, people at work would talk about how I could sit there and recite entire scenes of dialogue from this movie and just how dumb it was. It takes place, the majority of it is at Gillies, which is no longer in existence. There's also a really good performance by a great, great character actor named Barry Corbin, who plays his uncle in the film. But Travolta as a cowboy is just completely ridiculous. But the movie's a lot of fun in a dumb way. If you're into country music at all, it's got a good country soundtrack. A lot of stuff where they show concert footage from the Gillies concert stage with Charlie Daniels, with Mickey Gilley, with Johnny Lee, other guys. Barry, I don't even have to ask if you've seen The Great Urban Cowboy.
Yeah, I've seen The Urban. So two things stand out about this movie, and it's not Deborah Winger. It's not John Travolta. It is Scott Glenn, as you just brought up, too. He should have been, and I know he did a bunch of roles after. He was in this great movie in the early 80s where it was like a martial arts training. Does that ring a bell at all? I totally forget what this movie was, but he was so good, and Scott Glenn was one of these guys that I think could do anything on screen, but Madeline Smith makes my heart a flutter. And she's stunningly beautiful. She's, you know, this is the, we always talk about Funny Farm. That seems to make it in almost every episode. She was in that. But this movie's pretty bad. And I think partly, as you just touched on, the characters are very unlikable. There's nobody in this movie that I think has any sort of redeeming qualities. And the premise is fairly stupid. I mean, we can safely say it's pretty bad. And the dialogue, as you pointed out, you're reciting lines from this with your friends. The dialogue is terrible in this movie.
Yeah, no, it's completely ridiculous. And you talked about how beautiful Madeline Smith is in this movie. The scene that just always catches me is she takes Bud, the dirt poor kid, back to her condo in Houston that overlooks the city lights and stuff like that. And the scene is done to the Boz Scaggs song, Look What You've Done to Me. And it's just absolutely beautifully shot. It's like there are roses among the thorns here. The movie is a thorn, but there's parts of the movie that are really beautiful. And the scene where Deborah Winger and Scott Glenn are in the trailer, and she's just walked in on him having a, dare I say, a tryst with one of the bartenders from the Gillies, a girl whose name I'll never forget. Her name is Marble Ann. And she leaves the trailer. So it's just Scott Glenn and Deborah Winger there. And he proceeds to tell her, make me something to eat. Make it yourself. And they just basically get into a row from there. And it's a great acted scene. There are parts of this movie that are really solid. But then there's parts that are just so stupid. But yeah, you enjoy the fact that they're stupid. So that's our top five list. Barry's number one is Blackula. Mine is Urban Cowboy. Can't go wrong with either one of those choices or anybody, either one on the top five list. So, couple of questions that we didn't get to answer from our last Breaking Kayfabe Facebook site where people had sent him some questions that I wanted to finish off with, Barry, before we do the go home. Barry, one of the questions that was asked by Stan Guzik, since you are Mr. Florida, he asked, how strong was Florida's tag team division during their heyday?
Stan Double Goozle Guzik. That's a great name, by the way. It was very strong. So, I mean, what are you considering the heyday? The 60s, it was very strong when you had teams like Hiro Matsuda and Duke Kiyomoka. You had the Assassins. Very often, the tag matches were at the very top of the card, so they were main eventing. So they were absolutely huge. In the 70s, it moved down a little bit, and then towards the late 70s, when you had teams like Graham and Kern, Saito and Sato, and the Briscoe brothers, these guys were either semi-main event or main event as well. So I would say, you know, Florida, I don't think traditionally was thought of as a tag team territory. Somewhere, I think Memphis was always thought of as a tag team territory. But our tag team division was very strong. And I would say, I think the teams that we had were as good as any teams in the world.
I would absolutely agree with that. So next we have a question that you answered last week from Andrew Moses, which is your top five one-hit wonders. You gave us yours. I neglected to give mine. So now I am going to throw out to Andrew. Let's go Too Shy by Kajagoogoo, Obsession by Animotion, Black Velvet by Alana Miles. I really can't believe that girl didn't end up being a star. She had a great voice. 7 Year Ache by Roseanne Cash. What a great song that was. And my number one, I'll say it. Okay, here's where I get a little stupid, because it was part of my wedding. We did the song by Modern English called I'll Melt With You. There, I threw that out to my wife. Now I'll get a little, get a little love from the wife on that. Isn't that a great? Aren't I just a great guy? So one last thing before we wrap it up. Barry, we recently celebrated, unfortunately, the 2-year anniversary of David Bowie's death. So here's me throwing a surprise out to you. This is the second surprise, by the way. Give me your top three, right off the top of your head, your top three David Bowie songs.
Oh, shit. That's not fair. Starman. Absolute Beginners. Putting Out Fire with Gasoline, or whatever the fuck it's called. You really caught me off guard, too. Starman's definitely number one, though.
Okay. I'm going number three. Somebody had asked, I think, way, way a while ago about the fact that, of course, we begin every episode of Breaking Kayfabe with Spirit of Radio by Rush. And people had talked to me about, you know, was that your original choice? My original choice to be the intro song for Breaking Kayfabe was Modern Love by David Bowie, which is a tremendous song. I'll go number two, Heroes. And my number one song, my favorite Bowie song of all time, is still Space Odyssey, which is amazing to consider. That song came out almost 50 years ago, and it still sounds like it could have come out yesterday. It's such a great song.
Can't go wrong with any Bowie song, too. And Bowie, to me, is one of those artists, if you like his music, you like every song he's ever made. What a loss. What a loss we've had in music over the last couple of years, too. So, yeah, can't believe it's been already 2 years.
Absolutely. So before we do the go home, Barry, one last time, what is the date for the CWF Fan Fest?
Oh, my God, be there June the 2nd in beautiful Lutz, Florida. We will be having Bob Roop and Steve Kern, Buddy Colt, and more names coming shortly. It's an all-day event starting off with a private breakfast with select legends, going into the Fan Fest, then the two-hour Q&A with a catered dinner. That Q&A is moderated by Jeff the Booker Baudrin.
I was just acknowledging that I'll be there.
Okay. Because I know in the past I've called you Jeff the Baudrin Booker.
That's
so
true.
I was wondering if I did that again. And then we're doing the after party. And the after party is going to be a private event limited to 25 fans only, with Bob Roop discussing his days of running Outlaw and going opposition to not only the Knoxville territory, but what also attempted to happen in the San Francisco territory. And Bob is a very intelligent, well-versed individual. So this is going to be really exciting. We've had two fantastic events. One of the highlights, and people always say, is the two-hour Q&A that you moderate, Jeff. People rave about it. I had fans coming up to me after the last one saying that I didn't think you could top the first one. You topped it with the second one. So I'm real excited about the possibilities of this third event.
And where's that site they can look into ticket information again?
Yeah, absolutely, too. So if you go to eventbrite.com and punch in CWF Legends, you should be taken directly to our page. Again, this event is taking place at the Residence Inn Tampa Suncoast Parkway at North Point Village. Say that all in one breath. You can also find us on Facebook at CWF Legends Fan Fest or the Championship Wrestling from Fan Fest or something. Championship Wrestling from Florida Archives. And then, of course, the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Facebook page as well.
All right, folks, that's going to about do it for this episode, our Sweet 16 episode. 16 episodes, Barry, who would have thought it? I want to give special thanks to Brian Last and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Breaking Kayfabe is, in fact, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Until next week, when it will be She's Sexy and 17. A little Stray Cats there, Barry. We'll see you next time, folks. Have a good one.